This week in Retronauts, we're fit to be tie-toed. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, hosting this week. This is episode 463, As the Crow Flies, and we are returning, as the crow does, once again to the topic of Taito and their legacy. So following on from whichever episode that was a few months ago, where we talked about the early days of Taito, we are now talking about their kind of what they did in the latter half of the 80s. And with me once again for this episode, we have Ray and Brandon. Oh, I introduced both of you, but please introduce yourselves so that our audience can have some associations, like a visual cue to know who's speaking.
Yes, hi, it's me, Ray. Hello again. Mm-hmm.
Is that it? Okay. Yeah. Nice. And I'm Brandon Sheffield, and I'm the creative director of Necrosoft Games, and I also have a podcast called Insert Credit that you may or may not be aware of. So that's probably me.
All right. And you know me. So, you know, a couple of months ago, we talked about the early days of Taito, where they came from, what they made, how they made a lot of money with Space Invaders, and what they did afterwards. And we got up to about 1985 and almost made it through our complete list of notes, but not quite. So for this episode, we're going to pick up where we left off, and then we're going to jump into, we're going to talk about their stuff from 85 through 1990. And I don't know if we'll actually make it to 1990, but basically, they just released a lot of arcade games and did some stuff at home. And we're going to talk about those games. The ones that really pique our personal interest that we have a lot to say about, we'll say a lot about. And the ones that do not and that we do not, we will not. So that's our promise to you. We won't talk too much about things we don't know about because that's not what this show is about. That's more of a, you know, making it up as you go along kind of show. But not us at Retronauts. We're well informed. So we're going to start, like I said, back in 1985, talking about a handful of arcade games that all, I feel like all, I don't know, they're none of them are necessarily world-shaking creations, but all of them are kind of interesting and still fun to go back to. And the first of these is Mat Mania, which was developed by Technos Japan, who had previously published or developed Tag Team Wrestling for Taito and was terrible. I hate Tag Team Wrestling, but Mat Mania is much better. Do either of you have any experience with this personally?
I'm afraid None. Not.
No?
Nope. I never got into the wrestling genre, unfortunately, as much as I tried to like Fire Pro and such. That was my closest. I almost got there.
Almost. Yeah.
I'm kind of the same way, but I will say, you know, it's respectful that, or rather, I respect Technos for doing that. They were really becoming one of, like, the trustworthy sort of wrestling game developers at this time, because after that, they made a couple other good arcade wrestling games and such.
Yep. And they were certainly developing their signature visual style during this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tag Team Wrestling was not a good game by any measure of the word. It was a wrestling game where you had to choose your moves through a menu that would pop up. You would punch someone, and if you did it just right, a little menu would appear and would allow you about 1 second to scroll through a menu and select a command that you would execute. Awful. Just not fun at all.
Later seen when you play the Dragon Quest hero in Smash Brothers.
Yeah. Oh, how sad. Mat Mania loses all of that and is much more of a modern day wrestler. You know, something in the style of pro wrestling by Tri, or, you know, the Fire Pro series. I don't know about Fire Emblem.
It happens.
It does. It has, you know, holes, launches, leaps, pins, ring outs. It's not so much just a brawling game as a game about wearing down another character, another fighter's stamina. So it feels, you know, more kind of like what we would expect from wrestling games. And as you mentioned, they're developing their visual style here, and this looks like, you know, a rough draft for Double Dragon. There are lots of interesting little details in the ring and the audience. I really like the guys in the audience. There's just like a random selection of dudes wearing what appear to be Einstürzend Neubauten t-shirts. So it's a really, you know, Japanese developers, and I feel like a lot of animation studios were really into like some pretty esoteric Western music in these days. So you'll see stuff like, you know, Einstürzend Neubauten t-shirts in a wrestling game, or, you know, in the TV series Super Dimension Detonator Orgus, in the living room, the space where everyone gets together and discusses where to move their giant flying landship for trade and combat. There's just a copy of ELP's Tarkus hanging in the background. No reason. It's just there. It's just the Tarkus tank. So I love seeing stuff like that. It really feels, you know, like the creators are expressing themselves and the things they love in kind of subtle little, not quite copyright infringing ways, which is great. Anyway, a couple of other games that showed up for Taito in arcades in 1985 were not actually made by Taito. And one of the things that they were doing around this time was really picking up kind of on the idea of becoming an arcade distributor as opposed to just creating games for arcade. So there are two shooters in 1985, Gyrodyne and Tiger Heli, that both, one was created by a company called Crux that I'm not familiar with, Gyrodyne, and Tiger Heli was developed by Toaplan. And I think that's a pretty well-known game in the West because of the NES port. But both of these are helicopter-based shooters, two in 1 year, strangely enough. And Gyrodyne, it plays more like Zevius, where the, you know, kind of the forward shooting and also the bombs, whereas Tiger Heli is more of a What do you want to call that? Just like vertical scrolling with some power-ups.
It's like a Raiden prototype in a way. It's weird that there were so many. It's weird, actually. It's actually weirder that Raiden became so popular, because when you look at the history, that came out in 1990, and there's so many games that have like a really similar vibe in terms of how like power-ups and the shooting, like the visuals of the shots and everything, how that all works. So Tiger Heli feels like a Raiden prototype to me, even though they're not related. Gyrodyne is weird because it's got that that almost aiming, the pseudo aiming of when you move right, the shots swing right, and when you move left, the shots swing left, which is a like Zero Gunner would do that later, and other helicopter shooters would get more into the like swing shot thing, which is fun, but like, I don't know, put some music in Gyrodyne. God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, Gyrodyne looks and feels a lot like Zevius, and I feel like they just were intending to make it for Famicom later, just because it is not quite as detailed as Tiger Heli might be.
That's a pretty good theory, actually.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, you know, the different developers, of course, but also just 1985, I feel like, was a real transitionary year. You were going away from the, I don't know, the transistor games. I mean, already mostly left that behind, but like, it feels like there was a step from the past into the future in 85. And like, 86 is sort of a leap ahead for Taito, but 85, they were kind of figuring out what they were doing. So in that sense, it kind of makes sense for me to have Gyrodyne and Tiger Heli in the same sphere, like trying different things. And Gyrodyne's a little more like the past, but with an interesting input, and Tiger Heli's a little closer to the future visually anyway.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that was something you saw just in arcades in general. 83, 84 still kind of felt in some ways like a holdover of that earlier arcade era where everything was a little simpler. You had a lot of flat colored backgrounds. And then 85, people really started to push the limits. And, you know, I think Sega pushed the limits the most with Hang On. That was just kind of mind-blowing if you look at it in the context of everything else. But also you have companies like Capcom who are putting out Ghosts and Goblins, which just feel more detailed and complex than things that had come before. So yeah, I agree. This is very much a transitional year. And if you look at Taito's own shooter offering, their own internally developed shooter offering for this year, it's Return of the Invaders, which is just like it feels like you have Space Invaders and then you have Namco saying, oh, we like that, let's do it better with Galaxian and then Galaga. And then you have Taito in 1985 saying, yes, those are some good games. So Return of the Invaders is very Galaga-like, kind of like maybe visually more along the lines of Gapless, but it still feels very much like they were borrowing back, kind of like when you have Indiana Jones games that borrow from Tomb Raider or something. It just kind of feels like, well, you know, it's a little derivative, but I guess it's a fair cop.
Yeah.
But this definitely feels like an older style game than Tiger Heli does.
Definitely, and it winds up, I don't know, feeling extra dated because of the graphical style, which I think was meant to move things forward. But there's a certain quality to it that makes it feel old, and then the borrowing makes it feel even older. Even though it feels less modern than Space Invaders games that came before it almost somehow. I don't know. It's strange.
Mm, yeah, that makes a lot of sense too. But at least they kind of, I would say perhaps learned from this and sort of made better the Space Invaders-ish games later. Like,
For sure.
Lunar Loonies and such.
Yeah, I feel like it took them a while. They kind of let Space Invaders lay fallow for a while until, you know, I think they realized there's only so much you can do with Space Invaders before it becomes not Space Invaders. But sticking to that style was not going to win any hearts and minds at the time. So I feel like when you finally do see the return of Space Invaders, the actual return of Space Invaders, not this return of Space Invaders, in, you know, like 1990-91, then by that point, having more of a kind of very classic single screen almost style shooter felt almost, like transgressive in a way. It was so far outside of where video games were going that you almost kind of stopped and took notice because, whoa, you don't see games like this anymore. And then we have one more game that is very much of its time, actually kind of closing out the end of an era also, and that's TimeGal, which was not the company's first attempt to create an FMV-based game in the style of Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, Cliffhanger, et cetera, but I feel like this is definitely their most memorable and has certainly developed a lot of traction thanks to its home conversions, some of which were pretty accurate. But TimeGal, I think the big appeal is the fact that the cutscenes, the animation, not even cutscenes, just the animation that comprises the entire game was produced by Toei, kind of at the height of Toei's power. So it's great looking animation. And at the same time, it refuses to inflict real violence against its lead character, even though she dies constantly if you mess up. Anytime TimeGal dies, it goes to this cartoonish style where something really goofy and silly happens to her and she looks like a, you know, super deformed cartoon character. It's very interesting in the way it skirts around, like, I guess they just didn't want to promote the imagery of violence against women in arcades, but they also still wanted to have a female lead, which was kind of becoming in vogue at the time for games and Japanese cartoons, and, you know, put her into perilous situations. So it's a really strange but memorable sort of solution they came up with to kind of skirt around that and to have their cake, but also to eat it.
I'd say less about violence against women in general and just violence against a cute anime girl who we might be able to market later.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Okay.
I would say though that that's a really good point with that sort of thing, because like, first of all, I'm not a huge fan of these kind of FMV Laserdisc games, but seeing stuff like Dragon's Lair, where like the death sequences are kind of a little bit shocking, at least for a kid my age at the time, like I can see why maybe they would want to make this a little bit friendlier for some part of the audience. So I kind of do appreciate that.
Yeah, what I like about it is the, you know, the weird or unexpected deaths kind of give you a reason to explore the failure space as well, which is, it's nice when games do that, when failure is almost as interesting as success. Of course, once you've seen it, you've seen it. And so it's kind of
right.
Not right. That, you know, it doesn't have legs, and that's FMV games for you, but it's nice that they were trying it. Although, you know, I another reason I don't buy the violence against women thing is because they do like tear her clothes off. with some regularity.
Violence, though. That's just
kind of violence.
Embarrassment. Tee hee hee.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's a you know, a tricky sort of social moray space to navigate. I don't know that the game necessarily succeeds. I think, you know, there's something to what Ray said about, you know, wanting to have this cute character that they can market and put into, you know, image audio CDs and things like that. That probably factors in there a lot. But yeah, it is weird that there are dozens and dozens of unique animations for the main character's death in this, which, you know, they put a lot of creativity into it. And, you know, I respect that. But it is weird that a couple of the death states are just she dies of embarrassment because her top falls off, or like, you know, a dinosaur chomps at her and tears her pants off. Like, that's, you know, that's embarrassing, but I don't think you're going to die from it. I don't know.
It's clear who they were marketing this toward. I mean, it wasn't for young ladies.
No, and it wasn't for young boys either. I think it was made more for an older. Older boys.
I mean, have you watched anime for 12-year-olds? They're constantly skirt flipping, whatever. Like, especially in the '80s, that was just like panty shots all the time. That was what it was about. So I would argue that it was for young boys. That was what they decided to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. But one thing to consider is that this game did come out a little while after Japan passed those laws restricting kids from spending much time in the arcades. I think basically after like 5 or 6 p.m., kids weren't allowed in arcades. So all of a sudden, I feel like games began to take on, to a certain degree, Japanese arcade games began to kind of cater more toward older audiences. And you started to see, you know, more risque Mahjong games and things like that. Gal's Panic, etc., which is ostensibly tied to Taito. Not really, but kind of.
But yeah, that's for daddy.
Anyway, Time Gal, yeah, like the thing that really stood out in reviews and commentary about the game in the American press, like when it hit Sega CD and so forth, was like, how weird it was that she turns into this little cute cartoon character whenever she dies, because we just didn't really have super deformed anime at the time. You know, when we got SD Valis, they said no one
Sid
knows what SD is. That's her name's Sid now. Who's Sid? I don't know. That's who she is, because it's got an S and a D in it. So yeah, there's a little bit of a cultural barrier there, but I feel like, you know, the kind of mindless ease of playing an FMV game, like you don't really have to think about it too much, you just memorize and respond, and the fact that the animation is just, it's really stunningly drawn, like it's beautiful, and it goes to some really interesting places. She's jumping all throughout time to like prehistory, racing against dinosaurs and cavemen, dealing with medieval knights, and eventually ending up in the future in this big kind of like you know, space technology fortress where she has a shootout with the villain. Like it's all over the place, and it condenses a whole lot of just kind of, you know, time travel sci-fi into a really, really well-drawn 20 or 30 minute adventure, even if it doesn't necessarily make that much sense when you sit down and watch it, when you're not, you know, actually inputting the commands yourself, stuff just kind of happens. But, you know, that's, I think that's kind of given for the game. It's no fat, just all meat. That's it.
Yeah. She always felt to me like the long lost third member of Dirty Pair. With her visual design to me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also wanted to...
Kay Yuri and Time Gal.
Indeed. I wanted to briefly talk about the Sega CD, Mega CD port, because I think it's pretty interesting. Because it's, you know, obviously the FMV of the Sega CD, it was touted as one of its big features, but it wasn't actually that fantastic at it because it had trouble with colors and compression and all that stuff. And so they wound up actually doing a bitmap redraw of basically the entire game. And so it's all done in like frame by frame bitmap drawings. And it looks fantastic. It's got a really unique look to it that you are unlikely to see except in things like, I don't know, Dina Island on the Saturn. It's really neat and sharp pixels, and it's worth taking a look at. It's weird that they still actually put a border around it, because why do you need to do that when it's not exactly FMV anymore? But it's pretty neat. It's a good way to, I mean, I'm sure it was very expensive, but a good way to make something like that, that has this lush animation, look perfect on a platform that can't quite do it. So give it a look.
Yeah, I think that was a big part of the appeal of the Lunar games, is that they use that same sort of bitmap style for their cutscenes. Yeah. So you weren't getting a lot of FMV. It was just, they were pushing a ton of actual bitmap graphics at you. But yeah, this is more like, it's that, but with way more frames of animation, way more dynamic camera movement. Like, it was originally drawn for, you know, storyboarded and drawn in traditional cel animation and then converted into bitmap. So it is really unique and really stands out.
Wasn't it ported by Wolf Team?
That sounds right. Yes.
Yeah. Their logo's on it anyway.
So, you know, people who know a thing or two about anime cutscenes.
Yes, certainly.
Or that kind of bitmap. Yeah.
So there was another game featuring a lady that Taito published in 1985 or distributed in arcades called Lady Master of Kung Fu, which is pretty much, you know, Kung Fu Spartan X, one of the mini games that tried to be that, but it has a lady in a Chinese dress fighting guys instead of a dude in like Bruce Lee outfits.
You can probably find that name on like 12 different videos in a...
In
Chinatown video store.
No doubt.
A bunch of VHS tapes that are called that for sure.
Yeah.
It is kind of a neat idea, because you got like a scrolling action game, and then there are individual rooms to go in there that basically have bosses in them. And it's kind of a neat, like, advent calendar of bosses that you can go through.
Yeah, it kind of feels like... you know, this game would actually come out the following year via Taito, but Renegade, where you are in several of the sections where you have to, like, the town, especially the seaside area, you have to fight through different rooms with enemies inside. But also the way it's all kind of presented reminds me almost of Elevator Action, which is another Taito game. So it definitely feels like, you know, kicking around ideas within the same space, even if it wasn't the same talent, like, just those ideas are kind of in the air and percolating, and people are kind of pulling from them.
Yeah, I like these kinds of games that are sort of on the edge of figuring something out, because they give you a possibility space to imagine. Like, you don't know what boss is going to be behind which door. I mean, eventually you do, but when you play it for the first time, it's like there could be anything in there. I don't know. I like that kind of stuff.
I'd say also, like we were talking about with Time Gal and like that sort of who the audience was, I'd say a lot of the merit of this game lies in the title screen.
Sure.
Where we have a picture of the lady in repose, just legs akimbo.
She's definitely got short dress on, and when she jumps, it's that classic, like, when pausing to see Chun-Li during her spinning bird kick thing that people did back in the day. It's like, I don't know. I feel like that stuff was super lazy.
But for sure. Yeah.
That's what they wanted to do at that time.
And she's barefoot on here. I mean, scandalous.
So anyway, moving along from the Quentin Tarantino phase of this podcast, we should talk about Taito's really concerted push into the home market in 1985. Up until this point, Taito had published some computer games, but generally when you saw Taito games on consoles, to this point, they were all pretty much Western consoles, and they were produced and published by other companies. So like Space Invaders, you know, Atari very famously put together a very kind of wild interpretation of Space Invaders for the 2800 or 2600 that did really, really well for the company, but took a lot of liberties with the game. And you had games like Elevator Action show up as well. But in 1985, Taito started self-publishing on Nintendo's Famicom as one of the early third parties for the Famicom. And that was kind of, you know, I think them really setting up a stake in this new market that was clearly exploding and becoming extremely popular in Japan, especially with kids not able to go to arcades after 6 p.m. They want to play video games, so they're going to do it at home on their Famicom. So the interesting thing is a lot of their early games, they clearly knew their limits in terms of developing for a home console, having, you know, all their expertise in arcades. So they outsourced just about all their games from 1985 to third parties, ghost studios like Tosei and Micronix. And some of them are kind of bad and some of them are kind of good, but you definitely, I feel like these games don't quite, these interpretations of the games don't quite live up to expectations or what fans really deserved at the time. Certainly, people could have done better, I think.
I think it is what fans deserved.
Wow, so you don't think very highly of Taito fans, is what you're saying.
Yeah, get wrecked, fans of Taito.
I was honestly surprised when I played it earlier this year by how mediocre the Famicom version of Space Invaders is. I thought that was a sure thing. Like, how easy is it to do Space Invaders? But
right.
It doesn't feel good.
It feels wrong.
Yeah. The sound effects are off. Like the SG-1000 version that Sega published around the same time is way, way better, which is really bizarre. But Taito put their name on this. I was told that if you play Famicom Space Invaders long enough, eventually you start getting into content that is taken from Space Invaders Deluxe. But the thing is, you have to play it for, you know, more than like two stages, which is difficult because it's kind of badly made and it's actually hard to get that far, but also it's not that fun. Like, I'd rather play just about any other version of Space Invaders than this. Chak and Pop kind of suffers from a similar degree of, like, it's not quite right. And the SG-1000 version again was better. The PC version was better. It just feels off on Famicom. The levels have been redesigned slightly, and they require, like, from the very beginning, extremely precise control and just a really exact, like, frame perfect understanding of Chakin's kind of vertical movements and stuff. It's kind of weird. Kind of bad.
I see. Well, that's kind of sad too, because that port looks accurate. Like, it looks pretty good.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, it doesn't play right. Even though some of the other versions on, you know, SG-1000 and so forth are not nearly as smooth and don't look as nice, they just feel more enjoyable.
Looks like Sega wins again.
Yep, Sega kicks their butts. Although I will say, the Famicom port, NES port of Elevator Action, way better than the SG-1000 version. That's a game where scrolling really matters, and one of those consoles could scroll and the other couldn't. And that, you really feel it. You really feel it when you play Elevator Action on any system where it's scrolling like 8 or 16 pixels at a time, because that's all the hardware could handle.
You need scrolling in Elevator Action. Otherwise, it's elevator inaction, I guess.
Yes, exactly. So other games that showed up on Famicom in 85, 86, you had Frontline, which we talked about last time. Not a good version. Sky Destroyer, Gyrodyne. Legend of Kage showed up on Famicom.
Legend of Cage.
Oh, sorry, Cage. I forget. I was being pretentious. It's French, actually. Legend of Cage. Legend de Cage. Anyway.
Good Lord. Sorry, French people. but yeah, that game was all right. I mean, it wasn't great, but it was all right. And we all played it, tell you what. That game came out and people played it. And it definitely showed off that scrolling, that's for sure.
It did. It was one of the early games that could do the all-directional scrolling on Famicom even before the advanced mappers that were explicitly built to support that showed up, which, you know, that's impressive. This was one of Tosei's games that they developed. And you had a few other games on Famicom before this that did the free scrolling thing, most notably Raid on Bungling Bay. But you really didn't see a lot of that. And this Legend of Kage...
Gotcha.
Legend of Kage is it moves at a really fast clip, maybe a little too fast. Like you're jumping around, throwing shuriken, and all of a sudden you're dead and you don't know why. That's very much the game experience. There's a whole lot of flashing and strobing effects that, sorry for anyone who's sensitive to that. This game is not for you. But there is something kind of interesting about the game. Just the way it kind of is this sort of journey through the woods, up a castle wall into the castle to save the princess. And then it starts all over again, but in a new season. It feels very much like, you know, kind of a stage presentation or something, you know, like traditional Japanese theater almost.
It's a good way to do the loop thing. Mm-hmm. I like when a loop has at least a theme to it, and Seasons totally works for me.
And also the loops, if you manage to get through the first loop, the second loop, I don't know about the third because I've never made it that far, but the second loop introduces new enemies who are, you kind of get a handle on how to deal with just the ninja who jump around and try to slash you. But then you got these monks that show up and there's like these butterflies. It gets kind of complicated. But then, of course, you can get the bug zapper scroll where you stand in place, the screen flashes, and the enemies die because I guess they're made of insects. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, kind of a weird, memorable game. And I want to say everyone knew someone who had that game because I knew someone who had that game. And obviously, my experience is universal.
Yeah, no, I was saying that last episode, too, when we were talking about the arcade version. And I think it's still a neat little game as long as you get into that rhythm of going through even the first stage and then the loops. Like, it becomes a nice little fun action platformer.
Yeah, and it's fun how it has little unexpected mechanics that you wouldn't expect. Like when you get to the castle, kind of the moat, you can jump in the water and you can't attack anyone, but you'll have a little reed in the water so you can breathe through it and stay safe out of everyone's sight. Just, you know, they put some thought and care into it, and it's kind of janky, especially on NES, but it's still, it definitely stood out at the time just for its unique theme.
An acceptable level of jank.
Yeah. Sometimes the jank is part of the charm.
Yeah.
what do you feel about the level of jank in Takeshi no Chosinjo? That was also published.
Jank at
that
point?
Was also published by Taito.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten about that until I was putting this together. But yes, I think that is a game that merits explanation, which I will let someone else do.
Okay. In some ways, it defies explanation, but yeah, it's basically kind of a crazy, supposed to be crazy, platformer adventure game where you play some character, I guess, supposed to be B. Takeshi. This is based on B. Takeshi's ideas and concepts, supposedly. So you just play this sort of salaryman guy who gets fired. And then you have to go visit your wife and say you're leaving your wife and then try and build up money to go on a crazy treasure hunting adventure. Now, of course, this sounds a lot better than I'm making it out to be because you have a bunch of weird tasks to try and complete. And you like have to go to the karaoke bar and basically sing into the actual Famicom microphone. But because the Famicom microphone doesn't actually, you know, detect your voice that well, it's mostly just seeing what tones may or may not match well enough, and then it will score you. And then that's, you know, just weird money making tasks like that. For some reason, you get money from singing well at karaoke or something like that. I'm a little bit foggy on all the details. I apologize if it's not like super accurate, but essentially it's like, think about how someone may have first experienced like Simon's Quest without much of a guide by their side, and times that by like five, and you kind of have this game. It's like the best high level way I could describe it.
Yeah, it's a game designed by someone who hates video games, basically.
Yeah.
And wants to create a miserable experience for everyone that doesn't make any sense. And it, you know, just, it's not an intuitive experience.
And I will also say, capital S, supposedly. Yeah, Beat Takeshi said he hates video games, and so he was making this as basically a troll on any video game players out there.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily mean literally, just like, yeah, that's definitely how it feels, like just someone taking the piss, you know, as they say in the UK.
Yep, it's a big old piss take. I'll also mention that I mentioned, you know, playing Simon's Quest without a guide. They did publish a guide, but apparently it wasn't good enough, so they had to like make a supplement. So it was also like a different kind of troll, kind of getting money in a second way from kids or whatever.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, you know, this, the same spirit pervades Desert Bus many years later, but this actually made it to market and also is a full actual game that, you know, has a beginning and an ending. At some point, don't you like fly a jet or a helicopter or something? That's like a combat shooter space.
Well, like the climax is that you do end up going on your world adventure to go to the jungle and find treasure. But then you reach an ending screen where Beat Takeshi's head pops up. It's like, boy, why'd you take this so seriously? Why so serious?
All right. And then the person who spent money on it becomes a joker.
Yeah.
All I have to really say about this is that 1985 is also the year that the word kusoge started entering the lexicon.
Interesting.
So I'll just throw in that out there, that also happened in 1985.
I read that word came into being many years later to describe, I want to say, Frontline, actually. But, you know, this was just an internet source, and I don't know if there were any citations.
Maybe.
But I did stumble across that.
Peas in a pod, well, either way.
I just read the Japanese Wikipedia article for it, so...
Well, then I'm going to go with that because it's probably more accurate.
Yeah, turns out 85 is when it started getting mentioned. It's actually in Famitsu in 86.
Okay, wow.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so that internet source that I was reading lied. Very sad. Okay, so 1985, year of the kusoge. But 1986 is where Taito really...
Yeah.
I this is a killer list of video games. It's
a lot
really
of hits.
Yeah, like this is their second wind.
It's a KLOV in real life right now.
Yes, it is. Exactly. Exactly. It is the Clove. So we'll begin with Arkanoid, which is, you know, we were talking about how the return of Space Invaders felt old, felt just like dated. But here is where Taito took an old concept, like Breakout, which was nearly a decade old at this point, and made it feel fresh and modern.
Yeah.
Even though it's still just like a single screen game where you have a paddle and a ball that bounces around and you're breaking bricks, despite the fact that they built, you know, such a very staid, old-fashioned concept into a game, the game itself feels really just like, you know, it feels almost futuristic for the time.
Yeah, you can play it today. I mean, I think the thing that really works is Taito was actually doing a lot of this where they would take an existing or older game concept and then they'd be like, you know what, let's add power-ups to it. Mm-hmm. And but they did it in a way that was tasteful and sensible and actually enhanced your play experience. Like when they did that with Volfeed, which we'll get to later, which is like an evolution of Kix. It's just like, oh yeah, this is, I would have loved to have this before. Like the power ups that they give you are like, this is super useful. This helps me play Breakout, you know?
Yeah. And the power ups in Arkanoid don't break the game. They're not over the top, but they help you. So, you know, you can, and also there is a risk reward element to collecting the power ups because they don't just appear on screen and wait for you to pick them up. They fall out of caps or out of blocks that you break as capsules, and you have to catch the capsule as it falls. And that means you have to split your attention because there may be a ball coming back at your paddle at the same time. And you have to decide, do I want to get the power up or do I want to avoid missing the ball for high score? And that's that's an important question, but you have the option to collect a laser beam. And what that does is you can shoot up into the screen and you can destroy blocks that way with the laser. But that doesn't make the game super easy all of a sudden because, you know, the fewer blocks there are on the screen, the harder it is to hit blocks with the ball and the faster the ball goes and the more precise you have to be, you know, targeting. So it kind of works against you. You can do a multi-ball where the ball splits into three all of a sudden. And that's kind of like, you know, a little bit of a padding. If you can keep them all in play, it's great because they'll just keep breaking bricks. But, you know, if you miss one, that's fine. If you miss two, that's fine. It just puts you back to where you were. But there's also, you know, a power up that makes your paddle wider. There's a power up that makes your paddle very tiny. You can get a power up that just resets the speed of the ball back to where it was at the beginning of the stage. So, you know, each of these has value, but none of them are so essential that you necessarily want to risk missing the ball to collect them.
It's a very smooth playing experience, and I feel like, I don't know, the power-ups make me more interested in playing Breakout in general. I mean, obviously this is Arkanoid, but I'm talking about like the archetype of Breakout. It's more engaging to me when there's this extra layer there. And I also like how it keeps the paddle dial controller in play in arcades. It feels so good to play with that. That's why when they released it on the DS, they put out a little paddle controller. That was for an Arkanoid release, right? Or was that for
Space Invaders? Arkanoid DS. Gave you a paddle controller that you could plug into slot 2 on a DS or DS Lite, which was great.
Super cool.
The NES and Famicom version also came with a paddle controller. The Arkanoid 2 paddle controller that was only on Famicom, you could actually link. You could do two player, and you could plug two of them together, which is cool.
Love that stuff.
And then, of course, the Taito Egret 2 Mini has an optional paddle controller, and one of the games that comes with that paddle controller is Arkanoid. Apparently, there's a little bit of an emulation lag on that, but the spinner on that, I've mentioned before, just feels like shockingly good for the size. It's not flimsy, cheap plastic. Like, it has that weight to it that you want in an arcade spinner. It's really nice. So this is clearly a game that Taito has always really kind of used to put their best foot forward. Like, they always try to give you the best possible experience when it comes to Arkanoid. And that Arkanoid DS paddle was really cool because you could use it for some of the other games like Space Invaders Extreme.
Yeah. Right?
So it was, you know, it's worth owning. And now I think it's like $200 just for the thing itself, which is ridiculous. But
I'm glad I kept mine.
But yeah, it's definitely one that if you can find it affordably, it's one of the reasons I keep around a DS Lite because, you know, it's such a good experience. That game is so good.
Yeah, me too. I was going to say, though, you always want to get the laser. I am do or die with the laser in that game.
I want that laser.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. But, you know, the thing is, it doesn't always work in every stage because there are some... I mean, it works in every stage, but, you know, one of the things about Arkanoid is that every stage has a different block layout.
Yeah.
And there are some stages that have a lot of silver and gold blocks, which are... you know, the gold, I believe, are invincible. Silver can be broken, but after like three or four hits. And I don't know if the laser can shoot through silver. I can't remember off the top of my head.
No, not really.
Yeah, I didn't think so. So, you know, so sometimes it does block it. But, you know, you start getting the references to other Taito games here. You have you know, stages that look like Space Invaders and that sort of thing. And just a lot of really creative configurations. Like there are some stages where it's almost impossible to actually get started in it because it's just a line of unbreakable blocks along the bottom of the formation, but there's just one little space you have to shoot into. And if you get the ball in there, it'll bounce up around and then just, you know, automatically pretty much clear out everything that's blocked inside, but you have to get it up there first. So it tests your skills in a lot of interesting ways. And it's very fast paced, very unforgiving. Like you know, it's one of those games that I'll drop a quarter into anytime I see it in a retro arcade, and I'm immediately just destroyed because I forget how unforgiving it is right from the start. But it's still easy. Really good.
I think it's particularly interesting to be having callback references in 1985, like referencing Space Invaders and whatever. It's fun that like in 85 they were like, oh man, remember back in the day? I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Arkanoid isn't even the only 1986 Taito game that does that. Bubble Bobble also.
I meant 86. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, 85, 86, it's still, you know, early days for video games in the context of today. But Bubble Bobble also made heavy use of invaders. They are characters who appear in some of the later stages. There are stages that are designed to look like invaders. But, you know, when you go up against invaders as enemies, they hover around above you and they drop lasers down at you. So it's, you know, very much like the idea is, hey, there's these guys from this other game that you remember. Now you have to fight them in a different way with a little dinosaur that spits bubbles.
Yeah. We're Taito. Don't forget.
That's correct.
Man, Bubble Bobble, tell you what, that game sure did come out in 1986. And that, once you hear that one song that they have on loop a couple times, it's in your head for the rest of your entire life. for better or for worse. I mean,
it's 100 stages of that song.
Yeah,
it's 100
stages. It's a lot of that song. I love that game. It's really like, it takes the maze platformer and it makes me wonder what's possible. And then later they show you what's possible. But it feels like there's secrets around every corner there because you like collect the little the bonus power up things and there are secret areas to get to and stuff. At least in the NES game there were.
No, in the arcade game too.
Yeah, I never got as far in the arcade one.
Yeah, the arcade game is tough. It's meant to be played, you know, two players together. And you can just pump quarters in as long as you want. But there are secrets around every corner. That's why it feels that way, because literally this game is loaded with secrets. And the arcade version is really cool because the secrets are persistent across sessions. So there are some secrets that, you know, they're based on how many quarter drops there are or how many times player two has pressed start.
All right.
Or, you know, how many times you've shot bubbles. And it carries over from game to game. So, you know, you're building up these multipliers in the background and they trigger different things. So, you know, once you have an arcade machine that's been running and been, you know, played regularly for a few days, you never know what's going to appear in the first stage. Like you may just get the standard power-ups, sure, but you may get really advanced power-ups that give you all kinds of perks or, you know, warps to later stages just at unexpected times. So it's kind of this communal element that you didn't really see in games a lot at this point. And, you know, it's your fortunes are based on people who have played before you. And that's really cool. It's very distinctive. I mean, it's meant to be, like I said, a two-player game, so it's about cooperation. But then there's also this kind of idea of other players that you don't even know helping you out in ways that you can't even comprehend.
I love the bubble shooting and jumping on the bubbles. I find jumping on them a little easier in the NES version. But I just remember getting the machine gun power-up, if you will, where you're just shooting out bubbles like mad. At rapid pace and thinking that this dragon's really sick. He's like just vomiting bubbles. We need to get this little guy to the doctor.
Yeah. Get him a cold compress.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bubble Bobble has very simple looking graphics. It's kind of building on Check and Pop and Fairyland Story. But the graphics aren't nearly as detailed as in Fairyland Story. And for a long time, I thought, oh, this is like super dated, super bad. Why would I want to play this? And I didn't realize until, you know, probably 10 or 15 years after it first came out, just how good it is and how much depth there is to it. I didn't know anyone at the time who had it. And so I, you know, didn't have the opportunity to play it with someone until I was, you know, in an arcade with someone and we decided to play it together. And then I realized like, oh, this game, this is really cool. Like it's fine when you play it by yourself, but there is something to, you know, kind of coordinating with another player and strategizing and using each other's bubbles to jump on things and racing each other for power-ups and things like that. It's a really, yeah, it's a really charming, cute, simple-looking game with just a wild amount of complexity underneath.
Yeah, I think the visual style is, it's simple, but it's very effective, and it's, you know, everything is literally iconic. It is an icon that represents something. And so it's very easy to see what stuff is and what it's supposed to do. And I feel like the color use is very effective as well. So simple though it may be, I still find it striking. I was able to play it on NES with my stepbrother back in the day. And so I got to have that experience from the start. So for me, Bubble Bobble was always that kind of like really interesting possibility space to explore. And then when Puzzle Bobble came out on the Neo Geo later, I was like, holy crap, what can't these little dinosaurs do?
They know? May be sick, but look what they're doing with that surface.
Look at that. It's amazing.
So dynamic.
They've outsourced their bubble throwing to a machine now. They don't have to vomit them anymore in Puzzle Bobble. Very good.
I think like Legend of Kage, this sort of ended up on a lot of people's NES libraries, and it sort of, I think, has a really sterling reputation, especially in this country. And you can see that because it is on the NES Classic Edition, but not the Famicom one.
Oh, yeah.
So
that makes sense.
There's one, yeah, proof of iconic status.
Well, there you go. So I mentioned that Bubble Bobble looks very simple, very minimalist and dated. And I think that's because Taito put all the graphics that year, all the graphics, every one of them went into Darius, a game that has three times as many graphics as any other game at the time.
A lot of graphics.
It's so many graphics. It's just a wild gimmick. I don't know that it actually necessarily makes the game better, but it sure does look cool when you sit in the arcades and there are literally... It's a triple wide screen because they had three monitors situated in the cabinet and then used like a mirror based system to reflect that image, kind of like they had done with the projections in Space Invaders. But instead of like creating the illusion of a background, because Space Invaders didn't have the graphical power to do that, it creates the image of a seamless space.
Yeah, it's an overlap.
It's amazing. It's completely ridiculous, and I don't think it makes the game better, and maybe actually makes it worse, but it's just so cool.
Yeah.
And seeing that lined up next to Darius 2, they have that at Mikado in Tokyo, and it's just super impressive to look at.
That's science. You know, that's like Mr. Yeah. Wizard showing you how to make a periscope out of a toilet paper tube.
That's right. Yeah, this game is great. I refuse to pronounce it correctly. I still say Darius.
That's fine. Whatever.
It's, you know, I didn't find out that you were supposed to say Darius until you know, probably like 5 years ago. Cause yeah. I just never looked
yeah,
at it in
I mean,
Japanese.
Same here. I'm making videos about it. So I always look up titles and say like, can I find, you know, katakana pronunciation guides for these? Wait, Darius? What the hell? Yeah.
So, this is one of the instances where I'm going to say, their original title, they were wrong. They were just incorrect.
Okay. Yeah. I'd say live your
well,
life.
Clearly, you come down on the kick side of the kicks quicks issue.
That's right.
So you're just defying Taito at every step.
Yeah. So this game is great. It's just great as a game. It has that just absolutely ear piercing, ear splitting, treble heavy Zuntata soundtrack that's just like
yep. Thank
wow!
you for mentioning that. Yep.
It's just like, you know, you put your earplugs in and maybe you'll survive kind of situation. But I love this game because it's, it's one of the seminal side-scrolling shooters. There just really weren't that many that were that good until this, in my opinion. I mean, you know, there's Defender and whatever, and that's fine. But it's a totally different kind of vibe than this. This was like the side-scrolling shooter, in my opinion, up until that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, you had Gradius in 1985, which is, you know, slower, yes. More methodical
yes.
than Darius. Darius is definitely, you don't have to think about your power-up tree in Darius. It's yeah. just like icons show up and you get them and you shoot more stuff. You don't have to think, oh, do I want to strategize and get missiles first, or do I want to go for the shield or the option? None of that. Just, you see something with colors in it that falls out of a ship you blow up, you just grab it.
Yeah, that's a good observation, especially compared to Gradius, because, I mean, me overall, I prefer Gradius between these ES games, but I do enjoy going back to Darius for a little bit, just because it's, yeah, you don't have to think too much, you can just focus more on maneuvering and worry less about shooting, and then yeah, which makes sense for the super wide presentation of it.
I totally ignored Gradius basically. I just like put it out of my mind because
that's because you didn't own an NES.
It's because yeah, that's right. It's because Darius is the best, and it's got fish. It's got big robot fish and the flying king fossil, and just like, and it's got the klaxons when a giant ship is approaching, and it's got the branching paths. It's just, it's unbeatable. It's so good. And it just got finished being ported to the Genesis in Mega Drive in like 2020.
Right.
I love it.
So do you like link three systems together to get the full, how does that work?
You should.
It's just the one, unfortunately. I actually mostly played this game on PC Engine, which is weird, but they managed to replicate the sound super accurately on PC Engine. The terrible ear gouging sound. I like it, but it is ear gouging.
Do you want to explain the branching paths that you mentioned for those who are not familiar?
Oh yeah. It's very, Outrun like in a way, in that when you beat a boss, then you start on path A, and then when you beat a boss, you have a choice of going in two directions. So then you can go to B or C, or it's actually maybe not B or C. I think A, B, C goes straight up, and then, so it's probably like E or something. I don't remember how it goes, but each path has a branch, at the end of the boss. And so you wind up with, I don't know how many final paths there are, like 15, 12, something like that. There's a lot of final zones that you can get to. And so to be able to get to, well, I guess it's probably 26 total, because it's the alphabet.
Does it actually branch out that much? I thought a lot of them kind of combine and then, you know, sort of narrow back down and then spread out again.
It does branch out that much. I mean, okay.
some of the later games, the sequels, like Darius Twin for Super NES, the paths branch out, but then they kind of funnel you back through a bottleneck and then fan out again. So I guess every game has kind of its limitations. But, you know, looking at these mid-80s shooters, you have Gradius, you have Darius, and then you have R-Type. And I feel like there's a spectrum there of, like, dazzling speed to overwhelming complexity and precision. And Gradius kind of sits in the middle, and then Darius is at the other end of the spectrum from R-Type. So there's kind of a good opportunity here for you to say, like, you know, which of these am I in the mood for? Which better suits my needs and desires when I play shooters? So, you know, it was a rich era for people who like side-scrolling shooters.
For sure.
So in addition to side-scrolling shooters, Taito also made a couple of top-down shooters in 1986, starting with Kiki Kai Kai, also known as Pocky and Rocky, which was their take on the whole, like, I was going to say the Ikari Warriors thing, but Ikari Warriors was also 1986 in arcades, wasn't it? Maybe it was, I don't know, it was around this time, but you had, you know, like,
yeah, it was around this time.
Frontline Commando, like, you know, this top-down shooter thing, military theme. Ikari Warriors came around the same time, added co-op. Kiki Kai Kai does not have a military theme whatsoever. It's decidedly its own thing.
Battling yokai as a shrine maiden, using your little purifying rod to whack everybody away and then throw talismans at them. It's great. I love the vibe. It's got that. I mean, like, the first boss is the Azuki bean sifting yokai, and he throws beans at you. Like, if you played this as a young person that didn't know about Japan before the internet,
it seemed very alien.
Yeah, it was really like, wow, this definitely came from a different mythology than the ones with which I am familiar. I love it. I wish it were like about five times easier, personally.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I wish the Super NES versions were like five times cheaper as well. It's gotten way up there, but this series
just
has
play the PC Engine version. It's better anyway because it rules. It's PC Engine.
But was it released in the US? I don't believe it was.
No, it was not.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it was.
But this series has had surprising longevity. Besides the sequel, there was a follow up released on Game Boy Advance called Pocky and Rocky and Becky.
And Becky.
And Becky. Don't know who she is. That Rebecca.
She's in there.
Yep. And then there's also a sequel that just came out. It's not quite a remake. I don't know. I haven't played it, but it's fairly new for contemporary systems.
That's right. Reshrined is the English name.
Reshrined, yes. No more reboots. Now we're just reshrining things.
Yes. Typical sort of video game nomenclature these days. Put re in front of some relevant word to the game.
So a very, very unique game, and I honestly am pretty surprised that it did make it to the US on Super NES. Not only that game, but also its sequel. But, you know, it's great that it did. I'm happy.
It's Natsume that did it, right?
Yes, they published it here. Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, you never can tell what Natsume is going to do.
That's
even
true.
Today.
They're all over the place. Yep.
Yeah, who knows what they're going to decide to do. So that kind of explains it all to me. Natsume is like, I don't know, let's get this.
Yeah, I think that game is like in the same sort of pod as like Kendo Rage or like KO Flying Squadron, which are like, how did this manage to come out here?
Love it.
Hagane, yeah, there's a few more.
Right.
Hagane, man, that Hudson biz. When we do the Hudson retrospective, let me know.
Okay, yeah, I think I was thinking that might be a thing for next year, so I'll let
you
know.
There you go, I'm ready.
Yeah.
All right. So that was a unique top-down shooter. Much less unique was Halley's Comet, which is a top-down shooter that's just kind of a top-down shooter. The thing that makes it stand out is that at least the name was intended to exploit Comet Mania, which struck in 1986 as Halley's Comet returned to visibility from Earth for the first time in like 92 years or whatever the cycle is. And I was there and I saw Halley's Comet through a microscope or a telescope, not a microscope, through a telescope.
You're huge.
And it was as unremarkable as this game. It was just a little dot in the sky.
Yeah, it's so weird.
Yeah, talk about games that feel old. This game feels old.
I mean, they did go for it in a sense of like, you know, you have all these ship upgrades that get kind of crazy. And like that was sort of also explored in Slap Fight, which is not a title game, but it's sort of like that same sort of concept, which is like, just give us a bunch of crazy ship upgrades so we just like fill the screen with our own bullets or try not to lose them as we get hit by enemies, which might actually happen more often than not, but still. I mean.
Yeah, so a lot of evolution of the shooter genre coming from Taito in 1986, but also they were exploring the brawling genre. We mentioned Lady Master of Kung Fu, and we mentioned Technos' fighting games, but they really kind of brought all that together with a game that Technos developed and Taito distributed and manufactured for arcades called Renegade, which in Japan, of course, was called Niketsu Koha Kunio-kun, or I probably got that in the wrong order, but anyway,
that's right.
It was about hot-blooded teenage delinquents,
hot-blooded teens
busting out of their Japanese high schools in America. It was about the fact that someone who worked on the graphics really liked the movie The Warriors.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bit with the music, you get that like 50s on the waterfront kind of vibe. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't have that music in On the Waterfront, but the doo-wop rockabilly, etc. vibe, and with the pompadours, I think that's they thought that would resonate with American audiences in a way. It definitely resonated more with Japanese audiences. I think. I don't know if that's true. I just made that up. I shouldn't say that as a declaration of fact that it resonated more with the Japanese audiences. It is interesting to see this as like, was this the actual start of the Kunio-kun series?
Yes.
It was, right?
It is.
It's interesting to see the beginnings there and how that comes from what's it called? Matt Mania? Matt Existence?
Oh, yeah.
Matt
Mania. Right.
That's the one. Just because the thing that was, one of the things that was remarkable about the Kunio-kun games was that you could pick anything up and throw it and whatever. And, you know, that mentality comes from the wrestling thing where,
oh yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
There was so much that you could do with the grappling and maneuvering of people and objects. And to put that then into a brawler made it really feel like its own thing.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a game that I think maybe introduced into brawlers the idea of holds. I mean, you know, in Kung Fu, the little guys in the line could hold on to you and just kind of sap your health that way somehow. But here you could like grab someone's hair and, you know, shove your knee into their face and then throw them over your shoulder into someone else. Or, you know, once you knock them down, you could sit on their chest and just wallop their face. So, yeah, it definitely is like wrestling, but with dirty moves.
Arcade machines in the 80s definitely gave me an inaccurate impression of how much holding the head and kneeing the face was used in fights, because like yes. every game was like, oh well, all right, now you got to hold on to him and knee him in the face. This is just what you do. This is the main thing you do when you grab somebody, is you knee them in the face.
Yeah, that was a big beat 'em up thing.
So this game kind of split into three different evolutionary paths. There were the Kunio-kun games, which have thrived nonstop in Japan for decades, gone off into spin-offs. Sometimes we get them over here, sports games, adventures in medieval Japan. There's River City Girls. It's all over the place. Then you have really Double Dragon was kind of a like the next step of Renegade, taking that kind of, you know, post-apocalyptic, you know, American dystopia, urban hell combat thing and branching it out into multiplayer. and taking it, you know, even further into the whole like Warriors and Streets of Fire kind of thing. And then you have a few Renegade sequels that mostly came out of Europe because Ocean got a hold of the license and said, let's just keep making games. And Taito actually said, okay, sure, we'll publish them for you. Why not?
Maybe that, or Taito wasn't looking.
That's also possible. Well, no, you know, Target Renegade was actually published by Taito. So,
oh, yeah, yeah.
I think Renegade 3 might have just been Ocean acting on their own at that point.
For sure.
But yeah, kind of a game with a surprising legacy, even if it didn't necessarily make that big a splash at the time. And it was definitely not as visually impressive as Gladiator, which I don't know is a good game, but it's very... very graphically ambitious for 1986. It's a belt scroller with gigantic characters. You're just a huge protagonist, belt scrolling your way to where the boss is. And then you get into a one-on-one duel with the boss and you hack and slash at each other and your armor flies off until one of you is basically stripped to your, you know, to your underwear or whatever, your leather cod piece. I don't know, whatever
like
it is.
Time Gal.
Kinda. Yeah. And there are some lady characters that you knock off their armor too, but it's never salacious in this one. It's just like that's just how it is. You
whittle
someone's
somebody.
Armor down until they're vulnerable, and then you stab them, and they die.
Part of the job.
This game is pretty weird in its like puppety animation with the, you know, all the mm-hmm. joints connected, and I guess they did a lot of. I guess they used real rotation. I'm not really sure. Cause it feels like there's a lot of animation frames, but it also, the move set is not that expansive. So that's always been a curious point for me. I'm not really sure what they're doing there, but one thing I like about it is how someone just is throwing swords at you from off screen. And if you block them with your shield, then you can pick them up and add them to your sword, and your sword gets more powerful and gets flames on it and stuff. And yeah. I like that power-up system. It's kind of, I don't know, there's something very physical feeling about it.
Yeah, that's really cool. This is another good example, though, of like we were just saying about the puppety stuff, just developers in those days trying to do something with larger sprites and trying to figure out how to get larger sprites working in various ways. And, you know, the segmented body sort of thing is one approach to it. And, yeah, I think that's kind of what Taito is trying to do, is like trying to make this impressive. And they went with that approach.
Yeah. Without this game, where would Vanillaware and Treasure have been?
Nowhere.
All right, so that's 1986, and we're not going to make it to 1990 this episode. That's my promise to you.
Yeah.
But I would like to talk about 1987 at the very least, because this is kind of the year where Taito began to iterate on all the really cool stuff they introduced in 1986. So, you know, starting with Double Dragon, which also was developed by Technos and really feels like the next iteration of Renegade, with better graphics. It's very janky in the original arcade iteration. Like there have been lots of ports of this game that have refined it, but the arcade version is like, it has really low frame rates. Everything moves really awkwardly. The characters look kind of, I don't know, they have this kind of lankiness to them. It's really hard to describe, but it's actually a little bit off-putting. I discovered, you know, I played this Double Dragon through the NES version before the arcade version, so I finally got to play the arcade version. I was very excited, but everything just feels
it's stretched
weird.
Feeling. It's a weirdly, it's like a step forward and a step back from Renegade at the same time, mm-hmm. because it's less mechanically complex than Renegade, but environmentally it's more interesting, that's for sure. And it feels more like it knows what it's doing, but at the same time, yeah, I played it first on the NES as well, and then later in the arcade. And when I played it, but when I played it in the arcade, it was still like, I don't know, like 1992 or something. So it was still like far enough back that I could sort of put them in the same brain space. But even then, I still go back to it. And I'm like, I don't know, man. This is a little... I think the NES game's better. Like, I think it just might be better than the arcade game. But I like how... I think the main thing that this took from Renegade, and Jeremy, you were saying that this sort of like took over the Renegade branch of the Kunio-kun series. It's like the round, the super rounded muscles. Everybody's so round and and like lumpy and shapely in that way, which is kind of fun. It's I know they were trying to make like big Schwarzenegger muscle men, but they just look like a bunch of smuggling cantaloupes in their arms, as we used to joke.
Yeah, about. Like especially a Bobo. He's this big dude, and he's just like
just
kind of muscular, but also kind of like kind of looks like a walnut. He's all like wrinkly and got these weird bifurcations. Yeah, it's a strange game, and everyone like the way that their posture is really strange. Like they kind of are like leaning forward, like they're. How do you describe it? Like thrusting their shoulders back to make their bosoms look more impressive or something. So a bunch of dudes like, check out my rippling pecs.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's very strange. And there's like this very weird animation quality to all of them. It's such a curious game. And you're right. It is mechanically less complex than Renegade, but you know, that's balanced out by the fact that it has two player cooperative play, and it's almost impossible to get anywhere in this game in the arcade version as a single player. You really have to play it with another person, because otherwise the enemies just surround you and pummel you. And there is, it's extremely unfair. Like they have priority over your attacks, especially a Bobo, the big guy. Like you can be, you know, landing a punch and he'll start his animation and co-opt yours and you know, hit you. So it's pretty unfair, but there is, you know, there is the elbow attack, the elbow smash. This game, like Renegade, has a forward backward facing mechanic. So depending on which button you press, it's not you punch forward and kick forward. It's like you punch, you attack right or you attack left. And you know, the direction you're facing determines what kind of attack that is. So if you're facing in a direction and you punch forward in that direction, or attack forward, you punch. But if you attack backward, then you do a backward kick. So yeah, it just takes some getting used to, and it's strange. But, you know, it is compelling. It had a really cool soundtrack. The backgrounds were really interesting. There's just a lot going on, and I think it makes up for the fact that it's super janky, with the fact that it is very like detailed and had that cooperative element that was really catching on in arcades.
Yeah, but it does have a greater reputation on the consoles. But I guess, you know, that it wouldn't have that without the arcade version to be there at first. I'll also say, much like Renegade, and how this sort of, you know, if we want to think that this spiritually took over for Renegade, it also kind of got bastardized by its Western license holders, much like Renegade did.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, things like Double Dragon 5 and the cartoon and Battletoads Double Dragon. Thanks, Trade West.
Gotta love that movie, though. Mark Dacascos.
The movie, of course. Yes.
It's got some pretty good sets in. I mean, it's a bad movie. Like, don't get me wrong, but it rules. No.
Mark Dacascos is great.
Yeah, he's the best.
So, in addition to Taito and Technos's take on fighting, you also have kind of an evolution of, I guess, what they were doing with Gladiator, with Razdan Saga, which I think is much more successful. Like, the whole barbarian action thing was kind of, you know, it was really big at around this time, thanks to things like Schwarzenegger's Conan. Yep. And so you had games like Rygar and so forth, where, like, big dudes with a lot of muscles who probably smelled like sweat and old socks were just fighting hordes of monsters. And so here you've got a guy named Rastan, or Nastar, Nastar Warrior, if that's your preferred localization of it. I don't know. I don't really love this game, but it seems like it's historically important because it showed up on a lot of stuff.
I like it. I mean, it's clunky, but it actually feels good to play despite the clunkiness. Like, your attack just wangs right out in front of you in kind of a goofy-looking way, but I think it works, and I really like the enemy designs. I think that it like the you got your little blue guy that has four arms and has things in each of its arms, and it throws two of them at you, and then it doesn't have them in its arms anymore. It's like, wow, that's a really cool detail. I don't know. I think it looks good, and it plays well, and it's got some secret stuff to it. Like, within the first stage, there's an area where you can like break a brick below you so that you can get an axe, and you're like, oh, okay, I see what we're doing now. We got weapon power-ups, we got slightly alternate paths to go through the level. It's neat.
Yeah, I feel like this game kind of evolved out of like Dragon Buster or similar mm-hmm. games.
Sure.
Where it's like that very, let's call it, sword emphasized action game. Like you said, right. Where the weapons just kind of laying out in front of you while you're also just holding it straight up most of the time. And it's just meant to be like big blocky guy fighting other big blocky things and trying to navigate a stage in the middle of that. And that kind of works.
I feel like it has a good amount of detail to it. It like the sprites aren't huge, but they have such nuance to them. Like I feel like especially on a CRT, they look really good.
Yeah.
So yeah,
they got bigger in the sequel.
Yeah. They sure did. The sequel is so strange. It's a really weird game. I don't know. We can talk about that. What year is the sequel? We can talk about whatever that year is.
Oh, I forgot.
It's further out. Yeah. I feel like for me, the most enjoyable take on this sword winging action genre was ActRaiser by Quintet, which added also Civilization or SimCity to the mix, which is a weird combination, but it worked.
Predictably, I like the Legendary Axe series on TurboGrafx PC Engine. I think those are my favorite of those.
Though I will say, I feel like Taito's culmination of this concept came in Kadash, which gives you kind of the same style, but then adds, you know, you mentioned Dragon Buster, Ray, and I feel like mm-hmm. this takes that, you know, action RPG, romancia, you know, kind of Xanadu thing and really goes whole hog with it, even though it's an arcade game, and gives you, you know, four class characters to choose from with the different skills, kind of in the Record of Lodoss War D&D derivative style. It's one to talk about later, but I really feel like that is kind of the culmination of where this genre was going. And
yeah, I was gonna say, are we gonna talk about Kadash now? I'm always ready to talk about Kadash.
About Kadash. No, I don't know.
We should wait.
All right.
I love it.
I do want to talk about the other platform combat game that Taito published in arcades this year, which really I'd never heard of it or seen it and totally caught me off guard because it's a Toa Plan game, but it's not.
Talk about Wardner?
Yes, it's not what I expect from Toa Plan at all. It's it's basically like taking the cuteness of Bubble Bobble and you know, Fairyland Story and applying it to Ghosts and Goblins. It's really
little chubby round boy.
It's really strange. Yeah. Like everything's just adorable as heck, but also it looks really just, you know, soul crushingly hard.
Yeah. It's not easy. And I feel like this probably didn't have anything to do with Bubble Bobble or any of the others because it was Toa Plan, not Taito.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying like they were specifically doing that, just that kind of thread of cuteness that you see in Taito's games now suddenly applied to a Ghost and Goblins clone.
It's a weird game. There was a lot of this kind of stuff at the time. Like, there's a later one that Taito did make, came out here as Bones Adventure, where you've got like a weird little guy who's got an attack that's kind of a little bit of a strange arc to it, and it's punishingly hard and has some kind of obscure mythology to it, and it's got to be Ghosts and Goblins that inspired these things to exist in the world, because they're all kind of strange, and you're like, why'd you make this? Wordner wound up coming out on the Genesis and Mega Drive, but it had ports for the NES and PC Engine also that were almost finished and got canceled, because I think Wordner was just not that popular.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. PC Engine one was apparently finished.
I'm not sure who it's for, yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
All right, so another thread of Taito's releases in 1980, what are we, 87? Is sequels to their previous games. You have Arkanoid 2, you have Rainbow Islands, you have Super Kicks, Quicks, and really there's, I guess you could kind of consider Twin Cobra a sequel.
Sure.
You could almost consider Operation Wolf a sequel to Empire City 1931, which we didn't really talk about. But
I don't know if you could, because Empire City was Seibu Kaihatsu.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Developed, yeah.
All right. So Taito just said, we like this style of game. Let's make our own. But, you know, make it in the Stallone Cobra style.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't actually like any of these sequels as much as the originals. Am I wrong here? Like, can you defend Arkanoid 2, Rainbow Islands, or Super Kicks to me?
I can defend Rainbow Islands. But,
okay. Yeah.
Ray, you go for which? What were you going to go for?
Arkanoid, I suppose.
Okay, go for it.
It depends if what you mean by Arkanoid 2, because the Famicom version is obviously a little bit different than the arcade one, which is called Revenge of Dough. It is conceptually similar, but it's not a great port, I think. However, the arcade version, I really, really like. I definitely like it a lot better than the original. Hmm. It is a bit more challenging from the beginning, but the fact that how do you do that?
Given that Arkanoid is just like,
you think you can
play video games? You're dead now, right from the start.
No, I think Arkanoid 1 has a much better curve, at least from the beginning, than the sequel. But also the fact that you can very easily more warp around these stages in the sequel is kind of cool. Like the warps are much more forgiving, and you can it has branching paths, actually. Now that I think of it, another Taito game with branching paths. You can fill a whole dump truck of them.
Nice.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. And, again, they just kept innovating on the stage design and stuff. I'm trying to remember if there's actually any new power-ups, I'm super foggy on it all of a sudden, but nonetheless, I really like it a lot more than the original. You can try it on Famicom if you want. It just feels a lot less accomplished than the port of the first game, but yeah.
Did anybody else
better paddle controller.
Discover the Revenge of Doe subtitle after knowing about The Simpsons and get some real question marks over their head?
Oh, of course.
it was like in enough in that era that you could be like, I don't know. What's going on here?
Yeah, my first exposure to the Moai head named Do was actually the Super NES sequel that came very, very late in the Super NES's life called Do It Again.
Right.
So at that point, I was just like, is this like a Simpsons thing? What's going on here?
What is going on? That's weird. So Rainbow Islands, I'm not going to say it's better than Bubble Bobble. It's definitely different. I feel like they shouldn't have called it Bubble Bobble 2. I feel like that was perhaps an afterthought and a mistake, because certainly it's a single screen maze platformer type thing. But it doesn't really share too much with Bubble Bobble other than being one of those kinds of games. The reason that I think it's interesting and works is because it's a game where pressing the jump button is kind of like, that's the, like your risk reward, because mostly you're supposed to, so in this game you shoot rainbows out and you can climb up them like little arcs, but you can shoot another rainbow and then climb up that like an arc. So you're actually mostly traversing the world, and you're trying to get to the top of the level. That's where the goal is. And you're mostly doing it by creating a staircase of rainbows. And if you jump, all the rainbows fall down. And not always, but often. Like if you land on a rainbow, then they all fall down. And you can use that to defeat enemies below you, because the rainbows fall and until they disappear. You can also use it to collect power-ups that are below you. So it's this weird thing where you're supposed to be building a staircase. It's kind of like Fortnite. Yes. You're supposed to be building you're supposed to be building a staircase and climbing up it. But then you get into these situations where you're like, oh crap, this enemy's right above me. I have to jump. And so then you need to carefully time and position your jump so that you don't get killed and so that you land on a platform and you're in a safe spot. So it's like a very different mindset playing Rainbow Islands. And I do like it. But it's weird that you, like, we didn't get a good port of this game until like the Saturn era, basically.
Really, the PC Engine TurboGrafx version wasn't good?
Did it actually come out there? I know that Paris All Stars did.
No, I thought it was on CD.
Oh yeah, you're right. It is there. Okay, never mind. Yeah. Take that back about the Saturn era. It's 93 still though.
So relatively late.
Right. Yeah. And your power up can, I mean, your rainbow can go to two rainbows and then three rainbows. And then you're just like doing these rainbows of death. Yeah, that's right. I did play the PC Engine version. I forgot about this. Oops. It's much simpler to look at. And it winds up actually looking more like Bubble Bobble than the arcade original did. Mm. Interesting.
Okay. So do you want to stand up for Super Quicks or?
Nah. I don't really like that one. I mean, I think with kicks we can wait till full feed to enjoy ourselves again.
And then fair enough. Okay.
Super exactly. Kicks is just like whatever.
Also of note from Taito, and we're not talking about every single Taito game that came out. These are just the ones that I kind of said, oh, these are significant in some way. You have a batch of shooters, once again, all vertical shooters this time. Thundercade, Sky Shark, and Twin Cobra. Two of those are from Toaplan. One of them is from Seta, which I never really thought of them as an arcade developer, but here you have Thundercade.
Seta did the Super Real Mahjong series, so that's 100%.
I tend to think of Seta as arcade action, I guess. I tend to think of them more as like, you know, the not Mahjong, Shogi games. That was their bread and butter. Yeah. They made so many Shogi games and they went to the mats for those things. Some of the stuff they did was just ridiculous. But like, who cares about that? Then you know, you've got Thundercade, a cooperative top-down shooter, vertical shooter, but you're on military motorcycles. So that's different.
Yeah. And you can shoot to the side.
Then you also have, yep. Twin Cobra, which, you know, it's the sequel to Tiger Heli, basically. It's called Kyokyu Tiger. Yes.
Yeah.
In Japan. I like Twin Cobra better. It's easier to say for my anglophonic tongue. But yeah, it's pretty much Tiger Heli, but with better graphics and more things to shoot, bullets to fire, and you can also shoot sideways.
I played this one on PC Engine. It rules.
Yeah,
it's a good one.
Didn't they just put together like a compilation pack of these games?
There was a compilation pack of the Genesis releases of the Toaplan shooters. And I didn't buy it, and I regret it. They're like $500 now. It's ridiculous.
Gosh. Yeah, they're all super, like Slap Fight, MD, and it's ridiculous. No thank you.
Yeah, M2 is working on one of them, but not as a compilation. Like, they do separate releases.
Okay. I have trouble keeping track of all the stuff happening.
There's so much happening now.
Lots is happening, space. Yeah.
Yeah, which is good.
It's wild. Yeah.
But it's hard to keep
I'm
track
not complaining. And then also Sky Shark, which is kind of similar-ish, but you're in a biplane as opposed to a helicopter.
Just don't like biplanes that much, you know?
They're
like,
not inspiring.
I like, 1941 on the Super Graphix. In general, when I look at a biplane, I'm like, it's slow. Like, I don't know. Give me a triangle. That's what I'm looking for. Triangle ship.
And then one other game that I just wanted to point out because it's so strange is Midnight Landing, which I have not played this, but watching videos of it, it looks like the Night Driver of Flight Sims in that it is a flight simulator for arcades. So kind of like a precursor to Pilot Wings, I guess. But all the stages take place at night, so they're visually very minimalistic. It's like everything is black, and then you have kind of 3D spaces defined just by strings of lights that move and kind of rotate. I guess, you know, it was kind of designed for the same reason that Atari created Night Driver the way they did, which is that they just didn't have the technology at the time to really render these spaces realistically and in full illumination. So they just used lights impressionistically to give you the sensation like, oh, you're moving in toward a, you know, a landing strip. There's a city in the background, you know, and you're twisting through the sky and, you know, kind of changing your altitude and things are, you know, shifting in their perspective. But ultimately, a really weird thing to put in arcades, I would say.
Yeah. It harkens back so much to those old electromechanical games.
Mm-hmm. It does.
It's like the whole concept.
It's pretty interesting visually because, I mean, you're looking at this runway and you've got these points of light that are scaling toward you, and that's what you have to use as a guide. And it's really just about landing a plane across various airports. It's interesting and weird. It's something Rami Ismail would like, probably. I should tell him about it. And the arcade cabinet itself is pretty impressive because it's like the externally it sort of looks like the cockpit of like a jetliner. Like it's pretty weird and neat. I think it came out in Germany. It's like,
oh yeah,
which kind of makes sense because they love their simulations over there. So,
All right, well, that's it for 1987, and I feel like we can talk about a few things from 88 without going full into it, just to get us a little way through time.
Yeah, we're starting to get into the real good video games here, and it's going to get tough.
Yeah, Taito's
so coming into it.
Let's talk about a few of these things, and we'll see how far we can get in the next 15 minutes or so. So first of all, there's the Ninja Warriors, which is a belt scroller Darius style. I don't think it's a very good game, but man, did this game make an amazing impression when I saw it in arcades, because I hadn't actually seen Darius at that point. So I was not aware of, a tiny spaceship flying across three screens, but a cool ninja robot man and ninja robot woman just beating the crap out of an entire army across three screens. That was pretty rad.
Yeah.
And not really that fun to play, but God, it just looked cool.
It's got good music too. I like the music in that game. I also like how when you get, taking something from Gladiator, when you get damaged, it's not just your clothes. fall off. You get like, there's your robot legs, goddarn.
Yep, your whole chassis shown by the end.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. You're just Terminatoring your way down the screen. I never did get why this game was. I perceived that it was very popular in Japan, and I didn't get actually why, because playing it, I just not all the way there for me, though. I like the Ninja Warriors Again or whatever the Tengu Project or Tengu Project or whatever project.
Tengu
Project. Okay, the one that they made is really nice, but yeah, it's just, I don't know. It doesn't feel great, but it feels good to move around. Like you walk and slice perfectly in time with the music, so you're like shuffling and slicing with your dual kunai right in time with the music, so that aspect feels pretty good to it.
Yeah, I think this is around the time that Taito was really, I feel like they must have been feeling some pressure from Sega, because Sega was out there just, they were in the arcades, they were doing all kinds of cool looking stuff.
Yeah, like,
no one's visuals lived up to Sega's at that point in the arcades. They were just amazing. And I feel like, you know, Taito, having already established themselves as an arcade powerhouse a decade before this at this point with Space Invaders, they felt like, you know, we got to keep up. So they started kind of openly ripping off Sega's gimmick with the, you know, the superscaler and stuff. And the first of their games that really, really attempted that was Chase HQ, which was basically like, what if Outrun, but you're a cop?
Yeah.
Which, you know, take it or leave it, but it does at least put a different take on the gameplay. Instead of just being a race across Europe, it's a race across Europe to stop criminals, and you stop criminals just by smashing the crap out of their sports car. You have to catch up with them and then just crash into them repeatedly, and it's super fast. I think the visuals are, you know, the scaling does not sell itself as well as Sega's did. The technology just wasn't quite there. The art design wasn't quite there. But this makes up for it by being really freaking fast. It's such a fast-paced game that it kind of makes up for any visual deficiencies. And then you have the kind of the stress and the anxiety of trying to keep up with the criminals, trying to hit into them without smashing into other things and spinning out of control. It's pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think that one of the things that really differentiates it from Outrun as well, I don't know that I would say that it's not as convincing as Outrun. I mean, it is in some ways and not in other ways. Like, you could traverse between road textures in Chase HQ. So, like, you're going along the road, and then there's, like, barriers in front of you and you smash through them, and now you're on dirt for a while, and then you get back to a road. And so it kind of gives this interesting feeling to it, but it didn't have a huge sense of scale in the above space, like above the ground, though there were, you know, there's a tunnel or what, or mm-hmm. two or whatever. But it's true that in certain ways it didn't have that scale, but it was fast. I think that the stuff that they were trying with the roads is what made, well, part of what made the home ports not be as good as the Outrun home ports were. They just never... None of the Chase HQ home versions felt great to me. I don't know. I think that probably kept Chase HQ further in the back than Outrun, because Sega's Outrun ports were not perfect, but they were... You definitely still felt like you were still playing Outrun, whereas Chase HQ just felt like, I don't know. I'm not sure what this is.
Yeah, that makes sense.
At home, anyway.
So my actual personal favorite game from this year is New Zealand Story,
yes.
Which is another game in that whole Fairyland Story. I mean, I would say it's directly meant to be a sequel to Fairyland Story, given the
Maybe.
Name.
Yeah.
But, you know, cute little platformer. You're just a little guy. This time the little guy is a kiwi bird because you're in New Zealand. And it feels more expansive and more complex in terms of design, like visual, like, you know, stage design, than the sort of bubble Fairyland Story format. Instead of being a single screen, you have kind of large areas that you have free scrolling. The platforms themselves tend to be fairly dense, sometimes even maze-like. And you have a really fun set of actions because you're a flightless fowl. You can fly, but you have to commandeer a hot air balloon to do it. And that's just adorable.
Or a little yellow, weird loopy platform thing. I don't know what that yellow thing is.
Oh, yeah, there's that too. But the hot air balloons is what really stick with me. Because it's just a great visual of like a bird who really wants to fly.
Yes.
But he has to jump in a hot air balloon to do it. I think that's great. You can grab bows and arrows. You can swim. It's just, there's a lot of variety to it. It's super cute, super fun. Made it to a few different home level platforms, including the NES as Kiwi Craze.
And the PC Engine.
But it just feels, it feels more contemporary in its visuals and presentation than Bubble Bobble, even if it has fewer secrets and doesn't have the multiplayer design. But I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I like it a lot. Oh, you go ahead, Ray.
I was going to say one of my top two Taito games, for sure.
Wow.
Top Taito games.
Yeah. What is it you love so much about the game? Like, why does it rank that highly for you?
The aesthetic, for one. You know, it takes place in this wonderful fantasy land called New Zealand with
Never
a bunch
of
funny stage.
That's where they have hobbits, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I think that's where they got it from. but it's very bright and colorful. Like, the color palette, I think, is just really nailed perfectly for that kind of like cutesy animal aesthetic. And it feels good to play. Like, the jumping around, the shooting. Some people would call it floaty, but I think it kind of works in its favor. It feels good to me in this case. And it's just fun to like go through these giant stages. Whereas most of what would come out later, what we might call airplane hangar platformers, this is one of the better examples, first and better examples. I just don't know how else to put it. It just feels really good altogether. It's just kind of a happy game.
Mm-hmm. I like watching this kind of evolution of this branch of platforming, which clearly comes from the single screen space, where you can only jump up through platforms, can't jump down through them. And it's interesting to see this, because obviously the Mario direction, that's where things actually went. Mario, Sonic, yeah. that's all that vector. But, you know, Puzzle Bobble, Fairyland Story, New Zealand Story, then later Liquid Kids and stuff, that's all this branch. And so it's really interesting to look at this and imagine a different world of platformers where they're more informed by this, and like everybody turns into fruits when you kill them or whatever. And you know, right. it's I like this game. I also wish this one were a little easier, because it's not as bad as Liquid Kids, but there's a slight mismatch in difficulty and cuteness, in my opinion. I feel like the cuter it is, it should be a little easier. Mm. Maybe I'm alone in that feeling, but just a little, just a shade.
No, that's reasonable. I can understand. Yeah, it does ramp up quite a bit. But I think when you play it on the Egret Mini 2, it has like auto fire, so you can like...
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, Taito was really on a cute kick this year. They also published Insector X, a Hot B developed horizontal
Hot
shooter.
Hot B.
Hot B of all companies. I thought they just did fishing, but I'm learning so much this episode.
Oh, no. Oh,
they're hotter than you think.
Hot B did, they're hotter than you think. He is over there because is another little tagline that they used. Hot B did a lot of shooters. They did that steampunk shooter with the dirigible that I'm blanking on the name of.
Steel Empire.
Steel
yeah,
Empire.
That rules.
Yeah.
They
okay.
also did, they didn't do Detonator Oregon. Maybe they did. They did some Sega CD scrolling shooter. Anyway, Hot B.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, I only know Insector X through its Genesis version. And so when I sat down to look at the arcade version of this, I was astounded. Because the Genesis game is very much like, you know, kind of mature, realistic, whatever you want to call it, sci-fi.
Yeah.
But the arcade game is super cute. It's just adorable. You're like this little guy flying around exterminating bugs in like super cute spaces, and you're fighting, you know, big spiders that have angry faces and stomp their feet with little boots on the ends of their feet or their legs. You know, it's very cartoonish. And that did not make it to Genesis. It was
no.
It was just a total facelift. Really
they had to
bizarre.
Put sunglasses on it.
They make gave it him, cool. They gave the spider angry eyebrows.
Yeah, good times. Yeah, that game's okay.
Yeah, I mean it's fine as a shooter, but it's just weird that it underwent such a dramatic overhaul for its home version. You also had Kurikinten, which does not seem very interesting to me. I did not take the time to actually play it, but just
I
watching videos.
It.
It's a belt scroller. You are a little cartoon guy who can punch dudes, and sometimes you can charge up, you know, Kamehamehas.
Yeah, I like it.
It's kind of like a better version of Kung Fu than I think Vigilante would be.
Totally.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I like the music, and I like the vibe that you just like infiltrate this weird facility and then you're just going down further. And the way that you have to approach bosses is pretty interesting, because it's like entirely about fighting game style cross ups. Like, you have to jump kick past them and kick them in the back a bunch, and that's the the kind of strategy to do other, because they have a lot of special moves and you don't have so many.
Fair enough. A cute game that I do like from Taito this year is Chuka Tyson or Cloud Master,
yeah,
which is one of the earliest cute 'em ups. You know, there was Fantasy Zone before this, and maybe one or two others, but this is fairly early, and it's based around Monkey King imagery. In that sense, it's a much better take on things than Super Monkey Daiboken for Famicom. But it has a really great like kind of blend of Japanese and Chinese mythology. The backgrounds have this, a lot of them have this kind of great classical Chinese watercolor style with the Chinese perspective, where, you know, things in the distance are largest and kind of fade out, kind of a black and white, almost like sumi-e almost. The main character kind of looks like a monkey. He flies around on a cloud. You fight.
He does. He's got his little gold crown on there. You can more or less see it.
Yeah. You battle Japanese gods like Raiden, but you also battle a Buddha wearing sunglasses. Some of the enemies include bowls of ramen. So it's not a game that takes itself very seriously. And compared to a lot of these other games, it's actually, I think this is more in line with what you expect from cute games, Brandon. It's not insanely difficult.
It's not super punishing.
It's challenging, sure, as a shooter should be, but it doesn't make you think, wow, I just need to hang up my hat and stop playing video games now. But I like that some of the later backgrounds, especially later in the game, in the arcade version, not so much in the home versions, but they start bringing in these like really bold, variable thickness black lines for outlining things. And it almost feels like a precursor to what we would see in Yoshi's Island. It was a design, like a visual style that you really didn't see a lot in pixel art, where you basically had either like no outline or just a very kind of cursory outline around things. Whereas this really leans into that and gives things really heavy outlining, like it's all drawn with a, you know, an ink brush, which I think is really cool. And it's a very visually appealing game, and it's fairly fun. You know, it's not the most amazing shooter. It's not setting any records for imagination or creativity, but it just all holds together well.
Yeah, good way to put it. It's solid.
Yeah, it's really got kind of like a weird zoomed in feeling on some of those backgrounds with the thick outlines, but I still like it. I have a weird experience with this game because I played the PC Engine version first, and so then when I went to the arcade version, I was like, this is really missing some parallax scrolling here. Like, it's really not... It winds up feeling very flat, which kind of makes sense because it's sort of, you're on a painting backdrop in a way, but you wind up really missing parallax when you go back to it. The PC Engine version has parallax scrolling only on the boss stages. The rest of the stages are still very static, but I think that's the one thing that makes this game feel older, is the lack of anything in the foreground, basically. Still love it, though.
So where do you stand on the obligatory Toaplan shooter for 1988, Truxton?
Well, it's got a bomb that's shaped like a big skull, so I'm into it.
Yep. And that made its mark.
Yep.
I don't know. I feel like Truxton kind of feels like a sort of lead-in to the Danmaku style of games. Like, that wasn't really a thing yet, but you started having developers around this time just kind of see how much they could get away with in terms of pushing bullets around the screen. And I think the bullet patterns here are a little too thin and move a little too quickly to be true Danmaku, but I'm not good enough to actually play that far into the game, but looking ahead, you know, to some of the final bosses and mini bosses, mid bosses, like, you're definitely getting just like enemies flying around the screen, filling the screen with bullets in patterns that are predictable, but also they're moving so quickly that you really have to memorize what you're doing in order to play.
Yeah, I like it. I feel like it is sort of that early shooter for hardcore shooter fans kind of vibe. It feels like a beginning of the modern shooting game, like the branch that we have now. I feel like you you can definitely trace it to Toaplan, and I think this is the point where it really branches. And like, if you were looking for the point of the tip of the fractal, that Truxton would be it.
Yeah, no argument there. I think a lot of people think that too about the whole company's output. There's like, yeah, this is where it kind of started to get going.
Yeah.
Yeah, and thanks to sort of the Taito thing, you can kind of see Toaplan developing. Most of these games are going to show up on the Sega Astro City Mini V, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, Truxton is on there. I forget all the others, but yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not really enough. I don't know if I'm enough of a shooter devotee to pick up the Astro City V, but just as like a historic journey through the evolution of the shooter, I feel like it's going to be kind of an amazing bit of curation. So I'm kind of curious about it just for that reason.
I got to stop buying these things.
Yeah, they're taking up a lot of space, but they just keep getting better.
I know.
Sucks. They keep coming up with
how
more interesting
they?
Combinations of games.
It's criminal.
It's so annoying.
Why can't they just be mediocre?
Right, exactly. Just give us crap. Come on, take us back to the days of At Games, Sega Genesis, or whatever.
Yeah, bring me back to my childhood when stuff was bad.
Yeah, exactly. That way we could just talk about how we wish things were better.
And yeah.
And, you know, now that we're here, we're just complaining about it. So one final game before we wrap up this episode, and that is Superman, which I never saw in arcades. I don't know if I have to assume it made it to the US, but I've never seen this game in person. But it's really interesting because it's a belt scroller, but also because you're Superman, you can fly like anytime you want. So it kind of varies in places between, you know, just like a standard walk and punch shooter that you can also fly around in, to like a forced scrolling shooter. It's I don't know, but even when you fly, you're really the emphasis is on punching and kicking, because, you know, Superman has his heat vision, but that's pretty much it. I guess you can like throw projectiles of force by charging up, but it's a very unusual take on the genre, and, you know, I feel like it kind of works for the John Byrne era Superman of the mid-80s, where he had been kind of depowered and wasn't basically God. So, you know, there's...
Which works great for a video game.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's hard to make video games around Superman, which is why there's not really that many good ones. But this one, I think, at least is a convincing attempt.
Yeah, I just said, yeah. I mean, what else are you going to do with Superman? And at least this also looks good and feels good for the most part. Like, yeah, I can't say that about a lot of other Superman games.
Yeah, it's a kind of a weird one. It doesn't feel very Taito to me. And the graphics...
I mean, it's a licensed property, which Taito just didn't do a lot of.
Yeah.
It's right. Very odd.
Yeah, I don't know. The poses and the actions, it feels like... I don't know. It feels like a Western game to me. I don't know. It's a big mystery. I'm sure I should have looked this up beforehand, because I want to know who the heck made this. Like what team made this?
Yeah,
it's a curiosity for sure.
It's not too late for us to look really fast. And the director was Toshiyuki Nishimura.
Okay.
Oh, he directed King of Fighters '95. He directed the Astyanax Viewpoint.
Oh.
He's all over the place. All right. Oh, the Ninja Warriors. So there you go. Kiki Kai Kai, graphic artist on a lot of these games. So, yeah.
Interesting. Did Fighting Masters. Yeah, this person did a lot of interesting nonsense. On staff for Vice Project Doom. Nice.
Wasn't that ICOM? So
yeah, he has a lot of ICOM credits. He seemed to have moved on to there after
retirement. Right, so I wonder, yeah, maybe he moved on to there, and because I was wondering, like, maybe ICOM did this. That could explain its weirdness a little bit. But yeah, he was game designer of Rostan, so
Okay, well, you got a big dude with muscles.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of the through line that makes sense for me. Big stilted dude with muscles, I guess that's what... And the Astyanax also has that. Okay, all right. I'm seeing it now.
All right, so anyway, that's our two-hour mark, so we have to stop talking now. But we made it through 3.5 years of Taito history, which, you know, it was a packed 3.5 years.
Yeah, they had a lot going on.
There was nothing on the level of a Space Invaders in terms of like, whoa, this changed video games forever. But, you know, like, I think most studios would be super proud to have things like Bubble Bobble and Arkanoid and Rasten and so forth under their belt. And, you know, just in terms of distributing really kind of innovative shooters from great developers like Toaplan, they were doing some good work, you know, doing the Lord's work here in the mid-80s. So this was an enjoyable episode. I just, you know, we got to talk about a lot of cool stuff, which is always fun.
Yeah. So many game series that you still hear about were originated during those like 2.5 years that we just talked about, that's pretty wild. And they don't feel, a lot of those games don't feel as old as other games from that era, which is, Taito was, you know, I think they were on the leading edge of things for a while, and then they needed that kick in the pants from Sega and Namco to be like, uh-oh, we got to up our game. And then they, you know, they started to do it, and then in the 90s, they explode with power.
Yeah, this, all of this stuff was way more convincing than something like Jungle Hunt.
For sure.
Absolutely.
So good on you, Taito, for rebounding, and we'll regroup again sometime down the road, maybe in a few months, to talk more about Taito and the cool stuff they were doing as the 90s began. There's, you know, all kinds of great stuff we still haven't talked about, including Puzzle Bobble and what else?
Everything.
Elevator Action 2. Yeah, all
Elevator
that
Action Returns. Good, I mean, we're, like, even just in the next couple of years, we're going to get to a weird old Camel Try, Night Striker.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Volfeed finally.
Why not try?
Yeah, indeed. Kadash, Liquid Kids, Growl, which I love. Stupid Ninja Kids, man.
Yes.
Ninja Kids.
Yeah, there's some great stuff. So look forward to next time when you shall become servants of the Satan. And as we talk about Taito games. But in the meantime, please, gentlemen, tell me about yourself. I am telling you about myself first, Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on the internet all over the place. Look for me for now on Twitter. Elon Musk still hasn't bought it as of this recording,
not
so
yet.
I'm still there. So look for me as GameSpite, and do that thing where you like follow me and read about my learning to make pasta and making dumb jokes. That's my promise to you. I make many promises, and I'm good for all of them. Brandon, how about you? How can we find you on the internet?
Well, I'm Necrosofty on Twitter. You can follow me for talking about weird, obscure video game things and left-wing politics, lol. And when is this episode coming out? Do we know?
This episode is coming out, it looks like mid-June.
Okay, well, then I have two things to recommend for you to do. One is to wishlist my game Hyper Gun Sport on Steam, which I have mentioned the last couple of episodes, which is our cyberpunk volleyball with guns video game. Guns video game. Wow, what if I could speak about my own products? That would be really fantastic. And then the other thing you can do is, as of, I guess, very, very recently, our new game will have been announced at the PC Gamer Show, Demon School, our tactics RPG. You can wishlist that one on Steam as well. That's a very, it's like a tactics, new style tactics with some Shin Megami Tensei vibes and some Yakuza vibes going on, 2D, 3D hybrid. So you should check that out. That'll be visible to you by the time that you look at that. And also, you can enjoy my own podcast with Tim Rogers of Action Button and Frank Sfaldi of the Video Game History Foundation. It is called Insert Credit. You can find it anywhere that podcasts are distributed or on YouTube. We also do little YouTube versions of it. And last time I mentioned it, some people were like, we already listened to that. And so great. Good. Please continue to do so.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Ray.
Okay, well, I'm on most things on the internet as RDB, AAA, just those six letters. Twitter is one such place. I do a goofy podcast called No More Whoppers with my friend Alex, who lives in Japan. You can just go to nomorewhoppers.com to find that. And since the last episode I was on, I made a new game. If you have
for the Playdate.
If you have a Playdate, you can get Mash Gadget, which is inspired by a Hudson shooting watch toy. And if this was a Hudson episode, I'd be even more enthusiastic about telling you about it. But you can find that on my company's website, Bipedal Dog, bipedal.dog, and find other cool stuff on there. That's it.
I can't wait till I get my Playdate. It's still not a thing yet.
Same. I will be next year. I'm going to buy your game, Ray.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat, actually.
Yeah. All right. And this was a patron exclusive episode, so I don't need to tell you, the listener, how to support Retronauts, because you're already doing that. So I will thank you for supporting Retronauts, and I will look forward to producing more podcasts for you to get your subscription money's worth. So hope you enjoyed the conversation. Thank you, gentlemen. Let us reconvene in the semi-near future and talk about more cool things by Taito. And in the meantime, that's all.
We will catch you Zahato.